Hello and welcome to Life and Inside Job, the podcast where we centre our internal experiences as sources of comfort, nourishment and creativity. My name is Kate and I'm a writer, mentor, speaker, artist and facilitator, and my book, Second Spring, The Self-Care Guide to Menopause, is available in all English-speaking countries. Grab a copy for yourself or a friend on Audible, ebook, or even a proper paperback. And it's like a gentle hug. It's full of reassurance, help, and ideas to navigate perimenopause and menopause and to birth you into a vibrant second spring. And it also has a massive toolbox of audio tracks, of yoga nidra, of medicine circle, and meditations to give you some precious space. The other thing I love to do is have soulful, meandering conversations with people about how their inner lives nourish them. And in Life and Inside Job, you get to listen in. In this episode, I get to ask craniosacral therapist Francine Ford about how come our nervous systems are so incredibly jangled at the moment. And we get into a conversation about loneliness and what's going on with that. Overstimulation, boundaries, and yes, even a bit of menopause too. But Francine started by sharing how she's seeing women apologising all the time, and we get curious about what's going on.
At the end of the training, you have to do practical clinic time before they launch you out into the real world. So we saw quite a few patients. I think I must have seen, well, I don't even remember, between like 30, 50, I don't remember, it was a lot of, you know, just doing proper clinics. And what I was just saying is that I was looking through notes the other day looking for something, and it reminded me how women coming into the clinic would apologize for everything. Like, you know, sometimes before they'd even say hello, it would be like, oh, I'm sorry I'm late, or, and they weren't, or I'm sorry I haven't done my makeup, I haven't got my hair done, oh, I'm sorry if my feet might smell. There was always something that they were apologizing for, and I can remember it. It just, at first I thought it was just a coincidence, but a couple of months in, I just thought, why are we apologizing for existing? You know? And I've really noticed that I don't get it so much with the clients that I see online, but definitely the clients that come into a clinic space, they always seem really rushed, even though perhaps they haven't been. They might have stopped and had a cup of tea before they've come to see me. But they're like, as women, we apologize. We do. We apologize for existing. It's kind of, I think, ingrained in us from such a young age that we need to live up to all these expectations, that before we've even established ourselves in a room with people, we're apologizing for being there. Mm. You've no idea what those people are thinking about you. You've no idea, you know, yes, we all judge people in that first 5 seconds of seeing each other, but walking into a clinic space, I just find it utterly maddening and heartbreaking that the first things out of our mouths sometimes is, I'm sorry.
I think it's particularly noticeable. I used to see that too. And it's particularly noticeable in a therapeutic space because our senses are extended to notice the dynamic between us, to don't notice the dynamic of arriving, of newness, of settling, of leaving. I used to see that as a lot as well when people would come for body work and for medicine circles here. And my feeling was that it was a sort of semi-conscious preempting of an expected judgment.
Yeah.
Like a deflection, automatic deflection, because all the time, unconsciously, we expect to be, sorry, you're not okay in some
yeah. way
that we don't quite understand. And the not okayness is always a bit vague. I think it's like, I know that I'm just not okay, but I'm just trying to guess which way I'm
willingly walking into the space where you're going to expect me to be vulnerable. So I'm just putting it out there right now how not okay I am, but we still haven't yet determined how that's going to manifest in this session with you. But I've noticed it's funny because I've really been noticing it again. Like just even at work, people will walk into my office. I work in a school during the week. Like just women, stop apologizing. And I'm guilty of it. I mean, I can remember my daughter when she was a teenager. She'd always be like, "Mom, why are you apologizing? Like, shut up, stop apologizing." Well, one, I'm Canadian. Canadians apologize for everything. If you trip over a curb, you apologize. So, oh, sorry. Do you know, that's just something I've grown up with. I'm also neurodivergent, which I think you are quite predisposed to apologizing for everything. But I have really noticed recently that there's a lot of apologizing going on. And I don't know if it's because people are on a whole feeling a little bit more vulnerable. I think women collectively are feeling a little bit, you know, we've been through a lot the last couple of years, a lot. And yes, we're all out there supposedly back to normal. And I think we're really starting to feel the weight of stepping back into these lives. And I've noticed again, people are now starting to apologize. It's just like, stop it. We have nothing to apologize for. Yeah, it just drives me nuts. And it's that whole thing of, like I said, just apologizing for existing and apologizing for expectations that we should never put ourselves under the pressure to meet, because they're external expectations. And I think I'm really starting to notice that again. I've certainly noticed with a couple of friends that I've spoken to this week that are going to weddings, you know, the first weddings that have been rescheduled twice. And one of my friends said to me the other day, she said, "But I've put on like half a stone since I bought the wedding dress 2 summers ago. She's like, "What am I going to wear?" I'm just like, "Well, just buy a dress, or just, you know, wear that one a little bit tight." And again, it's that expectation of, what are people going to think if I put on half a stone? Like, what is that, 7 pounds? I mean, they're probably really not going to notice, if I'm honest, unless you point it out. And it's, yeah, so I'm starting to pick up on little things like that again. People getting very nervous, I think, and anxious about being out there, being present. And it's just playing games with their heads.
So for somebody who recognizes this pattern in themselves, how can they address it? How can they understand better what's happening within them?
The thing is, I don't think a lot of women realize they're doing it. I really don't. I think it's something that we are so almost programmed to do as young girls. We are raised up through the years to, you know, exude this whole thing of, you can have it all. You can grow up and you can have it all. You know, you can be this person, you can be that person, you can have all of this money, you can be a great housewife, you can be a great mother, you can be a great, you know, woman in the sack, you can be doing all the things. But really, we can't, nor should we be trying to aspire to that, in my opinion. And I think it just sets us up to fail immediately. So we immediately think we have to apologize because somehow we're not going to meet those standards. And I find that really sad. I find it really sad. I find it really sad just for women in general. I find it really sad for the younger generations. I've got a daughter who's 29. And some of the things I see her friends and her counterparts struggling with in terms of how they should be, you know, where they should be in their lives, you know, apologizing because they're not sorted. It's like, you're in your 20s. Your 20s are supposed to be a train wreck. Live. And I don't know, I just don't think a lot of women recognize that they're doing it. And I think that's half the battle. And I think in a really loving way, if you are with someone who you know does it all the time, we almost owe it to the women around us to say, you don't need to apologize for that. You don't need to feel you're doing anything wrong, in a really supportive way. Because I would, you know, I, even though it used to drive me nuts, because as my teenage daughter would deliver it, it wasn't usually that kind. It was like, you know, that bite that comes with teenage girls. But I think as grown women, we can do it in a really loving and supporting way.
Oh, I mean, I just have this beautiful vision of people stopping, women stopping each other in shops and going, looking at each other in the eye and saying, you have nothing to apologize for.
And I,
like, this chain of, the relief.
And I really feel that, you know, we almost owe it to each other.
Yeah.
Because it's not correcting anything. It's not like even like pulling you up on something. It's just that raising that gentle awareness, because then people can actually, or women can actually start understanding why they do it. Because I'm a big one for really embracing those feelings, those uncomfortable feelings. The work I do with my clients is all about, like, just feel in your body where you're feeling that emotion or that fear or that anger. A huge thing that comes up with women is, where are you feeling that shame? Because again, we are conditioned to have shame. You know, if you know, all through, think of through like secondary school, in Canada it was high school. I just look at my high school experience as nothing but hell. I was not good at being a teenager. I was awkward. I was clumsy. I had all of this stuff going on because my brain, you know, I was undiagnosed ADHD, ASD. I think I did a lot of apologizing in my teenage years. And I think a lot of teenage girls do. And we carry that all the way through. And I just think, you know, if we see our counterparts doing it now, I just think it would be, like, how wonderful would it be to have somebody say to you in a really loving, compassionate way that it's okay, you don't need to apologize for that. Because I hazard a guess, probably 99% of the things we apologize for aren't even, you know, happening. They're all something we internalize because of the fear, the shame, the emotions, the just that internal wobble that we might be holding on to. It kind of spills out as soon as we feel, you know, just get in there before they notice it. But people won't notice it because most of it is internal. And I think for me, when I see a woman who apologizes a lot, I can really feel there's like a sense of fear or sadness that kind of really sits within them, that is upsetting their nervous system in that moment. And yeah, so I just invite women to kind of help support each other through that, because once you're aware of it, you can, you know, you can just start to sit with it yourself and kind of get ahead of yourself, thinking, yeah, where am I feeling that discomfort or that wobble or that, you know, tension? Because a lot of this stuff manifests physically. So quite often, you know, you'll get a knot in your stomach, or, you know, that pain in your chest, not even a pain, but that heaviness in your chest. And I think if we can start understanding the way our bodies respond to things, we can probably rationalize with ourselves that we really don't have anything to be sorry for. It's just, that's how you feel in that moment, because you might have been triggered back to something that happened in your childhood, in a bad relationship, in a, you know, whatever situation. And it's just drawing awareness to it. And I think collectively as women, we need to be more supportive of each other in that way, and less competitive almost. And I still find
it all creates more loneliness. If you have this anxiety and a feeling of shame that is too difficult to share or too difficult to feel or approach or be curious about.
Yeah.
Then you have to keep yourself separate.
Exactly, because you might avoid situations where the discomfort is so palpable, you don't want to put yourself in, when, you know, into that position, where if you can just work through it in kind of like a somatic way, just feeling it. Because like I said, I'm a big one for just sit with your emotions for a minute. You know, if you know that seeing certain family members is really triggering and you're going to be really unhappy, So you basically have two options. You're either going to put yourself into that situation willingly, knowing you're going to have these discomforts in your body, right? And you can either learn to sit with it and understand why that person triggers you in that way. And by understanding that trigger and literally feeling it in your body, you know, if it's something that happens in your solar plexus, you know, and you're not breathing out, because quite often if we're in a state of anxiety or agitation, we don't breathe out, we don't exhale, and that makes you uncomfortable. And if you know that person triggers you in that way, you can put your hand over the area that you're holding the restriction, work through it, start to understand.
What do you mean by work through it?
Just really, because you can physically place your hand over an area where you're holding tension or there's some sort of physical manifestation of your discomfort, just by feeling into that space, feeling physically your hands on your body, touching that space, quite often you can face that fear of why you're being triggered, whatever emotion is coming up. And a lot of what I see with women and certainly my clients is that quite often we're more afraid of the fear than the fear itself. So, you know, if you're in the situation of not going to something because you know you're going to be triggered, you have two choices. You can either go into that willingly and try to make peace and understand your feelings about why you're triggered by that person, or you opt out and you stay at home. And that creates a whole other issue around loneliness and anxiety. And it's, you know, I'm really not trying to simplify this, because anxiety and loneliness are huge things for a lot of people that need a lot of very specialized work to deal with. But sometimes there are things that we can do for ourselves. And it is just that understanding of, okay, I know when I see my Aunt Mabel, who, you know, was horrible to me as a child and used to lock me in that other room to keep away from the grown-ups, I know that makes me really upset, makes my stomach hurt. If you can kind of rationalize with yourself that, yes, that happened, yes, it stuck with you, yes, it might trigger you in a lot of other ways in different situations. It might not just be Aunt Mabel that's triggering you. It could be a partner, it could be a colleague. But just starting to put a name to it and trying to just acknowledge that you have that feeling, it can sometimes just help take the edge off it. And then you might be able to walk into situations with a little less trepidation, because opting out and becoming disassociated and removing yourself from uncomfortable situations isn't the answer. Because that then creates a completely different type of vulnerability. You kind of become comfortable in that space of retreat. And then again, that just brings up a whole other.
Well, there's an interplay, isn't there, in between setting a boundary, approaching the boundary, encountering Aunt Mabel and seeing how close you want to be. And there's enormous agency in saying no and retreating. But it's a bit like with our nervous systems, we want to have flexibility to be able to go into contact and go away from it and have choice about that, rather than being stuck rigidly in one or the other. And that, you know, that's often what tends to happen, that we're sort of stuck in this kind of petrified contact and overexposure, or where we've retreated and closed down into a sort of dissociated state, and it's difficult to shift out.
Exactly, because I guarantee if you walk into that room with Aunt Mabel, you're immediately going to start apologizing for all of the things you didn't do. and again it's that constant cycle. I see it very secular, where it's just, you know, it's like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Either way, you're punishing yourself in some way, and it's usually on a cellular level and on a level that manifests as pain, illness, anxiety, loneliness, sadness, you know, in your body. And it's just, that's why I think, you know, if you are with somebody who you can see carrying these patterns, and if you're close enough to them, obviously you're not going to do it to somebody you've met like two or three times that you don't really know, just, you know, see them in passing and, by the way, did you know? But I think if you've got a daughter or a mother or a sister or a friend, it's like just starting the conversation, because so many women carry so much that can often be kind of dissipated just by the acknowledgement that people see you, and just by the acknowledgement that, like, we all feel these things, but everyone walks around. I mean, there's a lot of women out there masking a lot of things. There's a lot of women walking around pretending like not a damn thing is wrong. And I think it's damaging for themselves, and it's also such a disservice for other women. And again, I'm not making light of this, because it goes so much deeper. There's mental health issues, there's fear, there's abuse that goes into all of this. But sometimes it's just that acknowledgement, particularly one thing I've been looking a lot at recently is loneliness, and just acknowledging that it exists, and just acknowledging that, no, you haven't got it all together, and you might have a great job, and you might look amazing, and you might be in the gym 5 times a week, and on the outside you look like you've got this great life, but when you go home at night, you're either single and alone, you might be in a really bad relationship and on your own, you might be in a house full of people and feel completely on your own. And that's that loneliness. And it's, again, we just need to acknowledge, and we need to share, and we need to feel okay to say to our female counterparts that, I can see you're struggling with this. Do you want a coffee? Do you want to talk about it? I think we just need to start looking out for each other a little bit more, because I think the last 2 and a bit years, what I've really noticed in clients is a lot of people, obviously we were locked in, we had no choice but to retreat. And people are in a lot of ways struggling to come back out into the world. There's a lot of people that are still feeling very lonely and isolated. There's a lot of people that have forgotten about their friends. And I'm not saying this in a mean way, but there's a lot of people that have forgotten about the people that might need support. And we don't need to be everyone's therapist. That's not our roles. But equally, there's a lot of people that were struggling with loneliness before this pandemic that we've just gone through, who are struggling even more now. But a lot of their friends have gotten so comfortable with being in their own space with their immediate family that it's almost created this great divide amongst people. And I know I've got clients this last month. Some of them are really struggling with it, struggling with getting back into their social circles and getting back into the routine of going out, you know, where it used to be maybe every Thursday they'd go for a swim, or every Friday they'd go for a drink after work. Like we've not got back on track. And I think we do. We just need to start acknowledging where we need to honor our feelings of loneliness or anxiety or sadness. And we need to be able to offer that to women around us as well. Because I promise you, collectively, a lot of us are feeling it, but it's almost like we're not talking about it. I think that, I don't know why we're not talking about it, but I've really noticed, I've had a few people say to me, oh, I used to be able to talk to so-and-so, or I used to be able to be more open, but I really don't feel I can. And I don't know if it's because they feel that everyone around them has been so burdened that they don't want to add to that.
I think some of it is awkwardness. I was with a friend last night, and in her immediate family, there was a big drama and difficulty for them. Yeah, and she really missed people just WhatsApping her and asking her, how are you doing? Do you fancy a coffee? And somehow the big drama, she thought, she was theorizing, maybe people felt that she would be too busy, or that they didn't want to intrude, or there was this big thing that was happening, and that, you know, they would somehow be, it would be annoying for her.
Yeah.
But she effectively lost a load of support and a load of ordinary kind of like hanging out, human contact, yeah, exactly when she needed it. And I don't know if that's a British thing. This kind of embarrassment about strong feeling.
Well, it's funny because, again, I'm Canadian, and we're just known to be these people who, like, we really look out for community. We're really in it together in a lot of ways. And I do find it always makes me quite curious, because I noticed that here, I mean, I've lived here over 30 years. I've been here longer than I was ever in Canada. But I do still notice a lot of times that when there is a crisis or somebody's really going through something, people really don't know what to do. And I think, you know, I've seen a lot of friends over the years lose people or divorce or lose a job suddenly, that kind of thing, and or, you know, fall ill. And a lot of people really, like, they just retreat. And I think that did really happen. Again, we were locked in. It was hard. We all got a bit Zoom weary, you know. But I certainly noticed that I lost a lot of people that I really thought would always be there for me. I've never had a huge circle of friends. I'm not one of these people that thinks I've got 600 close friends. But I definitely, there were people that I thought would really always kind of be my ring at 4 in the morning if the dog needs to go to the vet kind of people. And when I went through something quite significant, there was two quite significant things through COVID. One, I was very, very unwell myself. And my daughter was very unwell. And I was really shocked by the people that I thought were my 4 in the morning ride to the vet people. Complete radio silence. And that really made me really start observing people in a different way. I'm a real people watcher. I think I always have been, but not just, you know, observing like what they're wearing or what they're doing. I've always really watched people's behavior and emotions, how people emotionally connect to each other. It's kind of this weird, it's this weird ASD thing that I've got. I just love watching the interactions. And I found it really strange that people who quite often come across as really supportive, big, you know, positive characters were the first ones to retreat. And I think a lot of people are going through that. And I definitely see a lot of my female clients, well, the vast majority of my practice are women. I only treat about 4 men. Everyone else is female or identifying as female. And I've got a lot of people saying that, you know, I don't know where my people are. I don't know where I'm supposed to go now. I don't know like what I'm supposed to do because nobody's coming back. Like they went off grid, you know, so busy with their own families and their own doing this and own doing that. I don't know where I belong in it anymore. And I had a client say to me 2 weeks ago, and I'm not giving anything away here, but I had a client say to me 2 weeks ago in a session, she said, I've never felt as lonely as what I do now. She said, because like nobody is around. And she was noting that how people the closest to her, again, had retreated and haven't come back. And I don't know where people have gone. I don't, like, it's curious how things have changed so significantly. And maybe I'm making more of it than a lot of people probably don't notice, because I know there's a lot of people that have started going back out every week. They go to the pub, they do this, they do that. But I've definitely noticed some clients saying that they thought the loneliness aspect of being locked in would end, but they're feeling more lonely now because they can see other people kind of moving around. We're not all in it together anymore. Yeah, it's just an observation. And I'm finding it more with women my age as well. Like I'm 52. And I'm finding a lot of women my age saying it, who previously, you know, a couple of years ago weren't saying it. They were busy doing all the stuff, busy out there, you know, doing all the things. But now they're really feeling it.
And so what is it about this age, do you think? That makes this such a hot potato. What's going on there? I mean, there's menopause. Hello, menopause is in the room.
So we've discussed this before. Now, menopause, it's a tricky beast, right? I don't see menopause. Don't get me wrong. When I was in like the hot flashes all night long, that was no fun. When I got lost walking my dog in the woods I have walked in for the last 20 years and couldn't find my way out, that was probably my lowest menopausal moment because I just thought, what is going on? standing on the Northern Line train in the morning with sweat dripping off me with a really hot man sitting in front of me, I'd be like, oh yeah, this is not good. Those moments were no fun. But I don't think we need to be scared of menopause as what a lot of women are. I think this, obviously this conversation, the greater conversation, it's amazing. And I'm so glad that women are feeling confident to have the conversation now, particularly in the workplace. And, you know, I think it's brilliant. But something really interesting happens at menopause, for me anyways. And I can see it with some friends. We all went through it at the same time. And I went through a very early menopause. I started in my late 30s going into perimenopausal state. And I was kind of finished by the time I was 47. So I'm done. I'm good. Don't miss those periods. Thank you very much. But usually when you get to this kind of menopausal age, quite often your kids are teenagers. They don't need you that much. So that starts to make you feel a bit lonely. You might become an empty nester. And it always amazes me how many women, and I try to say this in the most non-judgmental way, but it's probably going to make me sound like a bitch. The amount of women that completely lose their way when their children leave home. I beg women to keep somewhat of their own life. I went hard into motherhood when my kids were little. I gave up my job. I stayed at home for 13 years. I was a full-time dedicated mom. And I realized when my kids became teenagers that I better start picking up some hobbies here. I better start just going out a bit more and just doing a few things, because I saw a few women that were just a little bit ahead of me who were so distraught at becoming, you know, mothers without children at home. And it really scared me. I just thought, I don't want to be in that position. I'd also become newly separated. You know, my husband and I split up when I was 37. My kids were teenagers. And I just thought, oh, hell, this is going to get really bad. And then when you go into menopause, you feel just like nothing makes sense anymore. So if you've got all of that going on in your home, or you might be transitioning into a new job, because it's around this kind of late 40s, early 50s age that you think, right, if I'm going to do another career, if I'm going to go back to study, I've got to do it now. There might be health things. I know certainly for me, all of a sudden I felt really arthritic. I've got, I'm hypermobile. So my joints aren't great. And it was really, you know, once the estrogen drops, your joints start to dry up. So I felt very old and physically different. And it all started going on. And I just thought, this is too much. And then you throw in, okay, your kids might be moving out. You might be changing jobs. You might be having really big, significant changes. Plus you're in hormone, like, you know, disarray. And the loneliness can really hit you. And I can just remember thinking, you know, I've got to fight this with every fiber of my being to keep putting myself out there, because there were a lot of days I really felt like just staying at home under the duvet. And I was just very mindful that, no, I'm going to go back to study, because that's going to open up a whole new avenue of friends. And, you know, I want to walk away from a career that I don't enjoy. I don't want to do it until I retire. So it's just making those decisions, and also not just decisions about how you're going to earn your money and live, but how you're going to fill your day with things that interest you and people that you like to be around, so that you don't feel so distant and lonely from everyone in this age where everything is ever changing. Because it's a really positive thing. Like, you know, I promise you, once you get through those couple of years of the hot flashes and the not so much sleep and feeling more isolated, because you do feel a little bit like an alien getting lost in the woods, like, it's magical what happens to you. We need to be sharing our experiences with people. We need to be saying to other women, like, this is what I'm feeling. I'm feeling really sad, or today I am feeling lonely. How about you? Because I promise you, if you do, and I've done this, that's how I know, if you do, it gives permission for other women who have barriers up to kind of go, oh my God, me too. Oh, well, now you mention it, me too. And I think that's really important, because middle age is a really complex time. You know, we feel so differently about things. You view things through a completely different lens once you get into your 50s. And I think we do. We just owe it to each other to be having those conversations and really trying to look out for each other.
How did your lens change in your 50s?
By the time I reached my 50s, I'd been unmarried for a long time, and I'd come out of another long-term relationship where I was looking to settle down and get married. My kids, because I was quite a young mum, my kids were, you know, early 20s. So they were off doing their own things. Not so much, I mean, my son still lives at home. My daughter was off traveling the world as a musician. And I, again, it was like, I have really lonely moments. It's weird because I don't think, I've had very low moments where, yes, at one point I was diagnosed with depression. I now know it was undiagnosed ADHD, which can confuse things. But so I have low moments, but I wouldn't say I suffer from depression. And through that, a lot of loneliness, a lot of spending time on my own. And I spent probably 49 going into 50. That Christmas, I spent 2 weeks at Christmas just really still, really quiet, really thinking, what do I want for my life? Like, what makes me happy? What makes me unhappy? Because I was working in a job that really didn't make me happy. It was very high pressured. It was a job that you couldn't ever really take a breather from because I was an agent. And, you know, I remember very clearly the week that I thought, I need to get out of this career, because I'd been on email and phone calls until 1 a.m. with the magazine in New York. And then at 5 o'clock the next morning, I was then on email with people here in the UK. And I can remember my daughter saying to me for a couple of years, like, you look like shit. You are exhausted. You've put on a ton of weight. You look like you've been punched because your eyes are black with the circles underneath. She's like, I'm really worried about you. And my daughter isn't that kind of, she wasn't as a teenager, that kind of, mom, are you okay? She would just be like, lady, wake up. So I really had to sit down and start listening, because I thought, okay, I'm single, I'm overweight, I'm middle-aged, I'm really not happy. What am I going to do about it? And it's so difficult to really think, well, what am I going to do about it? Because in a lot of ways you feel quite powerless being in that situation, you know, and hormones raging, kids doing their thing as young adults. The world doesn't always make sense for women going into their 50s, you know, because the world basically tells us that we're irrelevant by the time we hit 50. None of the shops are suited for us. None of the magazines support us. Employers don't support us in menopause a lot of the times. We don't understand it ourselves enough to ask for support. And I did. I just had to really spend those 2 weeks sitting down thinking, what am I doing? And I had just started the year before that, doing anatomy and physiology and training to be a cranial sacral therapist, because it was something I'd always wanted to do since my 20s. And I thought, well, I'm going to do that. But I was still doing the agent work. And I hadn't planned on moving full time into cranial sacral work. I always thought, well, that's my kind of retirement plan. I'll just potter about in it. And then later in life, at least I'll have something I can enjoy. But it was that one 24-hour period where I was just on emails and phone calls. And I just thought, I need to shift this. So it was just sitting down, really taking stock. And it's difficult because my brain is so erratic. One day I want to be a writer. The next day I want to be a fireman. The next day I want to be, you know, a dog whisperer. I mean, I'm one of those proper, true ADHD impulsive, let's do it all, but we're going to do nothing because I'm going to get so overwhelmed. So it was a real challenge to sit down and think what I wanted to do. And I think I did this exercise where I looked at my values. I think I chose like 9 core values. And I remember writing them down, like, what do I want from life? What is important to me in terms of relationships and people that I have close to me? And then once I kind of really kind of filled it out, you know, just put it down, then wrote a little bit about each core value, what I find important in my life. I then looked at where those things were happening in my work, in my relationships, in my home. I think there was like two things out of that nine that were carrying over. And that was an eye opener. I was like, right, we've got to start just, you know, changing. And I'm quite, I can be very reclusive. I suffer from huge anxiety, which I've only just recognized as anxiety, which causes a lot of loneliness and has done all my life. But I tend to disassociate. A lot of people with extreme anxiety and sensory like processing issues, they have panic attacks or they're very visibly anxious. For me, I retreat and I become very still and I can stay at home for weeks on end and not see anyone, not talk to anyone. And a lot of people don't realize that about me, and it is something that I have to fight. So it was just really looking at everything and really acknowledging that I can either grow through my 50s and 60s in that way and lose people, or I can really start to create a life that I enjoy. And it's a small life. Like, I don't have tons of friends. I'm not a social butterfly. I'm not on a dance floor every night like I was in my 20s. And I'm okay with that. I've kind of really had to readdress how I want my life to look. And that means having two or three amazing friends who, through lockdowns, I have become so close with, that we are so interwoven in each other's lives. And that's enough for me. I don't need to have more people than that in my life. But I think it's really making a decision to tackle that uncomfortable stuff in your life. Really look at the things that you don't like. Really look at the things that make you sad, make you anxious, where you hold your shame. It's not easy to do. You know, sometimes you will need to get support through talking therapies or more somatic therapies, where, you know, I'm a huge fan of talking therapies. I would never tell people not to do it. But I also, because I am a very hands-on practitioner, I can also see where sometimes talking therapies just doesn't quite shift things on a cellular level. So sometimes you might need support doing both, to really understand where you're holding on to that shame and that grief and just those things that really trigger you. Because once you can really start to make peace with it and accept that not everything's always going to feel good, then you can start to really think about where you want to be in 10, 20, 30 years. And in your 50s, you should be looking at where you want to be 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's like, we need to get rid of this idea that we are irrelevant. Just that's a con.
Time to stop apologizing.
Yeah, time to stop apologizing, because, you know, being in my 50s, the women I'm surrounded with and the women that I know in this age bracket, we're some really bloody powerful women. And we just need to turn the volume up on that, because it is so easy for the younger, firmer, you know, less wrinkled women to make us feel like we're not. I mean, the best thing you can do is stop comparing yourself on social media. Stop following all the young influencers, the fitness people. Like, you could do, I said this to my daughter once, I said, you could do every workout they put up every week, you're still never going to have a body like them, because they do that workout 8 times a day. That is what they do. That's what they're paid to do. They're paid to look amazing. Stop comparing yourself. Become healthy in a way that makes you feel good. Don't worry about if your ass is sitting high enough. Because, you know, this whole, the pressure that we're putting on ourselves, that makes us lonely. Because again, you just feel that I'm never going to be like them. I'm never going to, you know, live up to that. And the standards that we put on ourselves, because we've been programmed to put these really high standards on ourselves. It's not even other people doing it. It's what we do to ourselves. That's the loneliest place you can be. But I know that by comparing ourselves to other people, that is such a dangerous headspace to be in. And I struggled with that for years. I've only really come to grips with that the last 2 years, to stop really comparing myself to where other people are in their lives. You know, it's, this is where I am. This is where I'm meant to be. if I want to be there, then I'm going to have to work to get there, but on my own terms. I don't care what so-and-so across the road is doing. She might be the same age, have similar, you know, similar things in her life. We're going to be different, and that's okay. Yeah, because comparison makes you very lonely. And it's horrible.
And if you could give us, can you give a small thing, a doable thing, a little tip for somebody who is listening to this and who is resonating with feeling lonely, feeling that they're apologizing, feeling shame, feeling lost? Mm-hmm. What can they do? Small things.
Just small things. Get away from the so-called wellness industry. Stop reading wellness memes. Things like, start your day on a positive thought. I because for a while I was involved and I got kind of, it's weird. I recognize now one of the things that I really have to fight against is my vulnerability at kind of being swept up in things, movements. And because I quite often struggle with this loneliness, I tend to get involved in businesses or things where I'll go along because there's a great collective of women. And I like the women, I don't actually like the cause. And so for a while, I was kind of veering into this kind of wellness side of things. And I was like, oh no, we're gonna move out of that really quickly, because I started hearing people saying things like, you know, well, you know, it's just, you just have to think positively and your day will get better. And I'd be like, well, no, like, it's really not. Like, things are sucky. You know, my kids had a breakdown. My dog has died. Like, I can try to be as positive as I want today. I'm still going to feel sad. That's okay. So I think we have a really toxic so-called wellness community from a lot of very unqualified people. And I think it's making women, particularly women our age, feel really bad about themselves. Move away from that. Like I said, just, you know, really think when you're around people, when you're watching things online, when you're reading things, how are you actually feeling? Because if you've got little whispers and little downloads coming into your ears, doubting what that person is saying and going, oh, I don't know if I agree with that, they're not your people. They're not your people. And it's okay to walk away from that and say they're not your people. So I think that's one of the main things, is really find who your people are. You will get those little downloads. Your brain is going to be sending you those messages. Acknowledge that. Things like finding something that you really enjoy doing. And it doesn't need to be huge. Again, we live in this culture where everything is online and everything is this grand gesture. A lot of what I do is, and the work I do with women, is find the small joys each day. It might be finding that one sunbeam that comes into your bedroom or some room in your house for 10 minutes in the morning and sitting there and just sitting there having a cup of tea. Feel the power of that sunbeam. You know, you don't need to go out and be, you know, jogging 5K and doing all these amazing things that you can post about. Find the little joys. Find, you know, if you like sitting on the back step with your dog, brushing him when you get home from work, do it fully and enjoy it wholeheartedly, because we are so overstimulated with everything that we have forgotten how to be still. And we've forgotten that sometimes it is okay to be lonely, because in those moments, sometimes we realize so much about ourselves and we realize what we want in life. You know, loneliness doesn't always have to be scary. You know, it's when it tips over to being an overriding thing that becomes a stressor or an anxiety that you need to address it. But sometimes just being alone is good. So find something that you love. Just, you know, if there's a certain bench that you like to sit on in the park, just go and do it regularly. You know, like I said, it doesn't need to be a grand gesture. Move away from always thinking that every day has to be a big event. And if it isn't, that you're somehow failing at life.
What I'm hearing is that it's like this move from the public and superficial into the private, realm, and private intimacy with ourselves.
Yeah, because I think we've been really shown, I think, in the last kind of 5 to 8 years, as social media has really picked up. And there are so many people who don't have social media, but we're still being influenced because culturally, everything, just to the way our news is being delivered, is so big, so dramatic, so like overkill. Just look at COVID. I mean, you know, every channel, every newspaper had banners and literally minute by minute statistics and fear and terror. So, and I think that has been such an influence from our social channels. We need to just learn to step back and remember that, you know, we're not meant to take all of this on. And no wonder you feel anxious. And I'm not saying this because I'm the expert. This is stuff that I've actually had to look at myself and go, Fran, you don't need to be going to that and buying that and, you know, putting a filter on that. Like, it's okay that you are who you are. And if you don't feel like, if I don't feel happy with that, then I will do something about it. But I don't need to be comparing myself to all these people and making me feel worse. And again, feeling that if every day isn't amazing, that, you know, I'm failing. And I really see this in my daughter's generation, because they like, they really think that every day needs to be something significant. Like, there's always got to be a moment that they capture to post. Or, you know, I work with teenagers at a secondary school, and it's just like, guys, just take a moment to feel your feet on the floor and just listen to the birds, take the headphones off, listen to what is going on around you. Because if you can connect with that, you can then start to feel what's going on in your body. Because, you know, we're so overstimulated, we're canceling everything out. And what it's doing, and this is what I can feel in people when I'm treating them, is what we're literally doing is tuning things out. You know, I personally hate noise canceling headphones. I want to hear what's going on in the world. I want to hear it, and I want to feel it in my body. Because for me, when I wear noise canceling headphones, I feel completely different. I feel void. I feel like I'm sitting outside of my body, because it, like, everything is just so weird. There's just, we're meant to hear the birds, we're meant to hear the wind rustling the trees.
It takes away our proprioception, doesn't it? It's a very strange feeling.
It's terrible. And what that does on a cellular level and to your nervous system is it creates this unease, this like dis-ease, if you like, where I can literally feel it when I put hands on people. Your nervous system, it feels like just before you get that static electric shock, that kind of energy going into it, that's what I can feel more and more in people's nervous systems through overstimulation. And it terrifies me because I'm feeling it in young children. I'm feeling it in a lot of women our age, where like we should be kind of getting to a stage where we're just being more at ease with who we are and enjoying life. There's so much anxiety and so much fear around this stage of life and so much pressure that, oh, I don't know, there's a lot of overwhelm. And I think if we can start doing the little things like noticing the small joys, noticing, or, you know, taking up a hobby or just connecting in some way with things that we like, just reminding ourselves who we are, because you feel it, you will feel it in your body. You're supposed to have emotional responses to things. Actively encourage yourself to have emotional responses, because that helps you get through this stage.
And for people who would like to use craniosacral work to help to rebalance their nervous systems, where do they find you?
Physically, I'm in London, in South London, in Balham, but I treat people virtually, which sounds a little bit strange, but it works really well. So I've got a global community of clients, mainly women. I kind of specialize in women's health. I get a lot of neurodivergent women as well, I think, because of my own experience. I just naturally attract people. So either physically, like I said, in Balham, or just virtually, which is quite magical as well. I can tune into people. I'm synesthetic, so I can literally feel what's going on in people's bodies even through Zoom. So it does, it works really beautifully.
And they contact you through Instagram, is that right?
So it's Francine_ Okay. And it's just Ford with an E at the end.
I've put the links to Frances's Instagram and also her email in the show notes so that you can find her that way. My book, Second Spring, The Self-Care Guide to Menopause, is available from your favourite bookshop. And if you're a sensitive person who likes the sound of using the seasons as a guide to life, you'll probably enjoy the Medicine Circle process that I offer one-to-one. It's such a safe, fertile space for you to explore your intuition and discover how you can move forward in a nourishing way. And you're welcome to book a 20-minute free chat to see if this might suit you. Also, on my website, there's a treasure trove of free yoga nidras, there are visual guides to the seasons, meditations and workshops for you to play with. It would be wonderful if you felt able to share this podcast with a friend, either on social media or even in real life. And if you could give it 5 stars and leave a review to say what you enjoyed about this episode, then that would just be brilliant too. Thank you so much for listening. I so appreciate you taking the time to tune in to these other worlds. I'll be back in your ears very soon.